Not that I'm going to lead this or anything, but I'll initiate, I guess. I assume you're all here for a reason. The title has something to do with life together and what that means in terms of community, and maybe some of us here have various experiences in community, whatever that means to us. Myself, I've lived in several communities and maybe can share about some of those models too, and I know that others have as well. I don't know what's the best way to start. Maybe if anyone would like to share an experience they've had in community that would get us going. Or are you all just curious?
Well, we know Byron was the host of the hall.
Yeah, that's the community.
Or the whole family, with the kids.
Yeah.
Are you going to show slides of that sometime?
Two or three have asked, and I did bring, a number of slides dealing with Hawthorpe Hall and the immediate countryside in which it's located in the Midlands, so they're available, yes, anytime they'd like.
You said that it was somewhat similar to Holden or something. Could you just...
Well, I think I can say a few things about Hawthorpe, and Lois, I think, can say things that are more germane to the individuals that were there, because I think she got to know them better than actually that I did. So we lived at this Lutheran Retreat Center for 3 months just a year ago now. And Hawthorpe Hall is an 18th century manor house that the Lutheran Council of Great Britain bought at the end of World War II to serve as a gathering place for Lutheran refugees who had escaped the continent at the end of the war. Most of these refugees came from what we would now call Soviet bloc countries, Latvia, Estonia, and then some from Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary. And this was a place where, as aliens in England, they could come and celebrate their common religious traditions, even though they represented various nationalities. And I think probably for a decade or perhaps a score of years, Hawthorpe Hall served this purpose rather well. It has changed now because the children of these exiles are not really attempting to retain the Estonian character or the Latvian character or the Czech or the Polish, but their children are growing up as English because they realize that there is virtually no chance of their going back to the homeland. But some of the first generation are still there. For example, who was called the governor of Hawthorpe was a man from Latvia who was fighting on the wrong side when the war ended and had to flee Latvia and left his wife and three-year-old son behind. He has never seen them because he can never go back home. He would be immediately arrested. And his wife and child cannot come to him, and so they exchange letters. But he's been gone so long, 30 years, that he says he never wants to see his son.
37
years.
He never
wants to see his son. Because he said, in no way can the son be what he is in my mind. And I'd rather have him in my mind than to know what he actually is. And while we were there, he received from his wife his death certificate in order that she might claim a pension. She finally had him declared dead. And so the reminders of World War II are there. Another fellow that took a particular liking to our son was a German who spent most of the war as a prisoner of war in America. But just before the war ended, his hometown, his village, was completely destroyed. His family was wiped out, and even the records that he was ever even born were destroyed. He has nothing to go home to Germany. He has no family, he has no village, there is no record that he ever existed. So he's living out his years in England, and he came to Hawthorpe, as he told me, I've come here to die in this community. It will support and sustain me for the years that I have left. But basically what Hawthorpe now is a retreat center which seeks to draw people there, and they, all they do is provide the building. And you have to bring your own program. But since there is virtually no Lutheran constituency in England, there are not many anymore who make use of the facility. The most use of it is made by German gymnasiums, who will send their students there for a couple of weeks, then take them into private homes in Coventry, and it's a crash course to improve English. And that's basically what it has been reduced to at the present time. The young people who come there are like yourselves in the sense that they are volunteers. And they come and help maintain this 18th century manor house, its large gardens, and its guest house, which is a converted stable. And they work there, supposedly about a 40-hour week, but no Englishman really puts that in. And in return for that, they receive then food and lodging. And if you stay a month, you get £1 a week spending money. Now, a pound is $1.85 about now. It was $1.71 when we were there. Then if you stay a little longer, you get £2. And if you stay a year or more, you get £3 a week spending money. So you get $5 a week to go in town or go up to the pub a half mile away. But they come here. And the type of young people that come there, however, I think are different than the type of young people that I sense are here. They tend to be, to a large degree, either American or German artists. That is, artistic people who don't like to live the middle-class economic life. And they're sort of at odds with their parents. They don't like the disciplined life of Germany. They don't like to be part of the father's business in America. So they have fled. And they go to England. Of course, for the Americans, they understand the language. For the Germans, it's close. And they gather here in this community. And they live with one another. Also, one thing about Hothorp is that it's extremely international. There are virtually no Englishmen there. They're either German, Finnish, Swedish, Norwegian, American, or anywhere in Her Majesty's Commonwealth. Australia, New Zealand, heavy on Commonwealth. And they're probably not Lutheran at all, but a lot of Commonwealth people. So the multiplicity of the denominations, as the director told me, he said, it is a miracle that we ever get a meal on the table. Because when you look at the kitchen staff, there are probably no more than two speaking the same language.
We met a priest in Rome who, when he went to work in the kitchen at Hothorp, could not understand the language. And he said, you know, after that experience, he said, I really had some suggestions to make, but I couldn't make myself understood. So.
This makes for a very interesting mix, but it also makes for considerable tension. We came home on the 5th of July. And of course, the 4th of July, no American could let go by, particularly if you were living in England. But in order to celebrate the 4th of July, we had to go over to the director of the hall, who lived in a bungalow in one corner of the grounds, and sort of under the cover of darkness in his backyard, bring out the popcorn, which is a luxury in England.
It's expensive.
Very expensive. And have a little popcorn to celebrate the 4th. And I said, why don't we take this over to the hall? And the director said, oh, no, you don't. The 4th of July is celebrated in secret here in the backyard. Not because we're in England, but he said, the other nationalities don't appreciate it either. It's too nationalistic. So there were these constant tensions as well as excitements when you have such a mix of nationalities in a relatively small group of people. There would never be more than 150 at the peak of the summer season. Part of the time we were there, the community didn't number more than 20. And still, on that 20, you would probably have 7 or 8 nations represented. Some of these, we had one girl from Sri Lanka, who was an Anglican. We had 2 or 3 Anglicans from England. But if you didn't like it, Hothorp, when you wanted to, I mean, it got on you. All you'd have to go is a few miles, because all across England there are these youth retreats or youth hostels. It's one way in which many of these 17th and 18th century manor houses are being preserved. They're being turned into retreat centers. And one about 20 miles from us is called Little Gidding. And if any of you are familiar with the writings of T.S. Eliot, this is where he retreated and did much of his writing. And some of his most famous poetry comes out of his experiences at Little Gidding. And there was quite an exchange of individuals from Hoathorp to Little Gidding. Or they'd go somewhere else in England. The country was full of them. But the biggest tension that I observed there, and it'll be interesting if I observe it here before we leave, but we're going to be leaving, I think, before the season reaches its peak, and that is the young people who came, many of them to sort out their own lives, found it difficult to live with such a mix, but actually found the guests an impediment to their community. And you had this almost constant tension between the volunteer staff and the guests. There was no umbrella program to which both were invited. See, the guests brought their own program, and the staff simply served as hotel servants. And the tension was there all of the time. And the guests didn't get good service, because the volunteer staff didn't want to be bothered with them. They're intruding in our community. They wanted their own community. They wanted to retreat from the world, and they wanted to retreat from the ways of lifestyles and so forth from which they had come. And they wanted to be here in this isolation in the Midlands. Type of thing.
It seems from what you've said that both in its inception and in its present operation, it functions as a kind of refugee camp. Originally, real political refugees, and now perhaps refugees from
social,
from bourgeois society. At either time, when it was refugee camp, that it had that's kind of a negative definition of community. Then, at either time, did it have a positive defining purpose?
Well, this is the question that the rector asked me when we were preparing to leave after 3 months. He says, do you think this place is a failure? And my response to that was, as an institution, I think so. But I would in no way make that judgment on what has happened to individuals. That is, I don't think the community aspect as a positive thrust ever really emerges. But individuals find their lives greatly enriched by it at times. So I think some individuals rise above the situation, but it is a refugee center.
And just the opportunity to withdraw allows a certain kind of personal growth and
for some.
Mm-hmm.
For some, withdrawal means continual withdrawal. Almost imprisonment within cells. And there were people there that had problems. Like the director said, what they need here really is not a pastor. What is really needed here is a psychiatrist. So that's what's really needed. And I cannot offer that kind of leadership, because the situation was such that some people would come there because, well, this is a churchly place and the kids will get straightened out here. Well, it wasn't equipped or designed to serve that function. One of the more interesting facets of our experience was that there were two young men from Germany that were there. They had dropped out of the university.
They've been here.
And they've been here too? Oh, yeah. I think there's kind of a circuit, and Holden is a lot of Hoathorpians end up at Holden. I think a few Holden people go to Hoathorp, kind of ride this circuit. But these two young men were not particularly pleased when their mother showed.
To bring them home. Get them back in the
university. The father was back in Germany waiting for them to return, but Mama didn't wait.
Yeah.
Mama came.
And they didn't come home right away, so Mama called the director before long.
They both went home, but vowing they were going to come back. So we would see some of these family tensions there, and some of the parents would really come to rescue their children from the community, almost like if we had a Mooney deprogramming on the part of the mother there.
In what ways can you see Holthorpe as a model, maybe, or don't you see it as really a model for community?
Model for community. It's a model in this sense. Europeans treat the 18 to 25 year olds as living a certain stage in life. And the European student is not a child, neither is he expected to be an adult. He is a student. And it is almost part of his education that when he completes his classroom work or in the midst of his classroom work, he puts his knapsack on his back and he travels. And Europe provides means by which they may travel and places wherein they may stay. And in a positive sense, Holthorpe is on this route. And therefore, it could be a model community in helping a person reach his maturity by coming and spending a period of time here, working and sharing with multinational clientele. In this way, there is a bit of a model. But I don't think that there were actually many that made it that model, but some of them definitely did and came away from Holthorpe enriched by their experience.
What was your role at Holthorpe?
I was the faculty for a program that did not exist. That is, I carried the title Theologian in Residence, which was the creation of the director in order that he might be able to find some family that would come and live in the hall and present a lecture-type program once a week, but the rest of the time, depending upon what his own program was, simply to be available to talk with the young people. So it really was not an academic purpose as a faculty member, but it was simply to be a listening ear. Ideally, one should be there from 6 to 9 months. And the clientele that the director sought to fill this slot were American college and divinity school professors who were on sabbatical, who wanted to have a place to live in England. And being right in the center of the country, you weren't far from anywhere. So it was for your convenience and for his help. Essentially what it was designed to do.
Mommy, read me a book.
All right, I'll be back.
Maybe one of the things that this evening should do, which is one of my first reactions, is that the word means many different things. And there has been some attempt to clarify, like commune as over against collective, and other things, but I'm not sure that I could give you that. I know people use those sometimes carefully and sometimes not. It can be economic interdependence, like four people sharing the rent of an apartment. It can be a religious order, Sister Ingeborg being a Protestant, member of a Protestant one, we're probably more familiar with the religious one, with the Roman Catholic one. I was pastor of a group that chose the name Community of Christ and lived in the middle of Washington, D.C. for 8 years. And I think we were, at least in the 60s, typical of some other communities. In fact, one time in Kansas City, somebody realized there were a lot of these, and so we sent a delegate We found out we were in existence 4 years, and we were one of the longest lived communities that came. So that there's a very short time span to most of them. The ones that seem to be, to seem to have the most possibility of going on for some time and seem to be the healthiest, that's a judgmental word obviously, were the ones that had a clear sense of purpose. The one that impressed me the most was Reba Place Fellowship in Chicago, which is still going. Started with Mennonites, it's got other denominations, but a sense of purpose and some justice issues and a lifestyle. They work out of the community at whatever job they have, like if they're an engineer or what have you, but they all live on the poverty level of Cook County or city of Chicago, whatever that is at that point, so that their benevolence is phenomenal. I mean, the things they can do with people who take the skills they have that job and then don't use that money, but let that be the corporate benevolence. It was just staggering what all they could do with, well, I don't know, 10, 12 families, maybe it's a little bigger than that now. So I think probably people have different agendas as to what, some might be interested in trying living in community someday, some might just be curious, as Paul said, but it seems to me that that there's a lot of different possibilities for where the discussion could go.
John, I'm interested, you talked about purpose. What was your purpose in your community? Did you define it?
Yes, I think we had some bound. I'm not sure it was as clear as Reba Place Fellowship that took their name from the street they were on and had it. We at least described ourselves, if we did not define ourselves, we described ourselves as ecumenical, and there were 9 denominations. When we had about 70 people, there were 9 denominations. The associate pastor with me was a Benedictine monk, so that it was not only, I don't know what that word then is, interchurch or ecumenical, it was Roman Catholic and Protestant. We even had a Buddhist who came every day, every Sunday, said she didn't understand our liturgy, but she liked the singing and she liked the spirit, so we were even. She was really a very lovely person. We were a worshiping community, a Eucharistic community, and I guess the purpose was some understanding of the church exists for the, not for itself, not for self-preservation, but exists, kind of takes its form by the issues of that day, the issues of the world of that day. So if there was anything that defined the group, it was active in the civil rights movement and in the poor people's campaign and in a soup kitchen. And so no matter what your words are, if you have begun to live out a kind of a very low budget, no church building. We worshipped in a donated space in the basement of a row house in the inner city. I earned my income somewhere else, so we didn't have any internal expenses. Once you have a couple premises and start, then the way you live really says who's attracted to that and who's turned off by that. But I would say it was the major justice issues in the nation's capital in that span of 8 years that provided the focus. And it seems to me that not that that was the only way that you could be a community, but communities that had an action outside of themselves were somewhat different from those who were satisfying the needs of the members who came. I don't want to get real technical, the difference between Trelch's distinction between church and sect, there are also some disadvantages to a kind of social activist group. Sometimes it's irritating to have somebody who has such great needs that you can't get on with the next protest march, and you are kind of violent to the one who really has come into the community seeking some compassion, and you're really so busy that you can't do it. And we tried to have a balance, but it is true that the church really can nurture, and the sect is kind of knowing where it's going and doesn't have time for the maimed and the blind and the lame, and that also is part of church. So I'm not saying that one is the thing and the other isn't, but we tended, I think, to be more sect than church in a kind of technical sense of that.
Yeah,
But we had lots of fun. I don't mean it was a self-righteous kind of, we're going to save the world. In fact, much of the fun was a kind of nonchalance about what we were doing. Didn't change the world, but we planted trees on the city lots, whether the tree was going to grow or not, you know, kind of.
Is a justification for this kind of community that by living together or very closely, you free up a lot of time and money that would otherwise have to go to just maintaining a household. And that way you can be much more dedicated to the common purpose that you've all agreed upon.
Yes. At least we found that to be. Yeah. We had some shared apartments. The equivalent of barn raising is to help one another move in the city or something. We seem to do that a lot. By not having self-preservation as our thing, we could put our offerings together, which I think when we had 25 families, the budget was about $24,000 that year. And there wasn't any wealthy people. Some of them were in Social Security, so it was more than tithing. But that meant a fairly healthy possibility of funding some things that no one else would fund, and just something of the sense of solidarity to evoke one another's gifts, I think, was part of it. I don't think any one of us would have had some of either the fun or the courage to tackle something if there hadn't been another 40, 50, 60 people who kind of supported you.
But by working together, you've created for yourself a form of security, a certain amount of power through the collective offering and so on, and then freed up the time so you have the leisure to do this kind of activity. Really what the community seems to have done is to have allowed you to liberate yourself from household tasks in order to dedicate yourself then to a higher, or presumably higher, common purpose.
I think one distinction that can be made is the term household community, because that defines a certain size of community. Mm-hmm. Whereas Holden here, we're anywhere from, 186 today to 430 at the peak. And in that sense, that notion of community is more of a sense of belonging to something. But when you're maybe a part of a household of maybe 5, 6, 7 people, there's more of a level maybe of commitment and interaction possible between people. And I think, too, the 60s have sort of been a time of re-evaluation in many ways, and a lot of people are turning towards new lifestyles, new patterns of living for economic reasons. Perhaps it's cheaper to share a house than to have your own apartment, perhaps out of a sense of loneliness and alienation, perhaps out of a sense of freedom, as you spoke about, you know, freeing up money, freeing up time so that you are then more able to do other things. And I guess those are some of the experiences that I've had in the various communities I lived in. Maybe one that I'd like to point out in general was a community support system in Philadelphia. Basically, it's really influenced a lot of who I am and what I'm seeking to become. And by talking about that community, I'm really talking a lot about who I am, because it really sort of articulates that which I'm trying to do. It's called the Life Center, situated in Philadelphia. Basically, what Life Center means is it's a supportive neighborhood of people, most of them who live in household communities. Not everyone does. A few people live in apartments, but it's an agreement that a group of people, currently about 150 or so, are living in the urban, poor part of Philadelphia, amidst the poor, but are trying to identify what that can mean as a support system. I think a lot of the experience of the 60s, especially people concerned about justice issues and human rights and civil rights and whatnot, was that there wasn't the human support system to sustain the people. Just getting out there and protesting is not enough. We need human support, physical support. And so out of a need for that, a life center emerged, which is the human support system. Perhaps now it's about 24 households. Each household is autonomous in itself. And in a sense, each household is a mini community. They make decisions together, they share in the cooking, they share in the cleaning, they share in the child care, if their children present. They might have a particularly spiritual focus. the household I lived in, every morning we had worship together as sort of an office for 20 minutes at 6:30. So the group discerns together what that lifestyle will be. You know, in a sense, they have control over how they will live their life at home and what's important spiritually, economically, socially, and whatnot. And in a sense, there's a freedom there because it's a cooperative endeavor rather than an individual one of going out and trying to make it on your own. In addition to the whole life center approach, there were people who had chosen to live simply to free up their time and maybe work on what might be called a bread labor job, 20 hours a week. The rest of their time, they were involved in various collectives, which were volunteer groups working on various kinds of justice issues, whether it might mean the B-1 bomber, or whether it might mean what's going on in Namibia or South Africa, or whether it might mean education or nonviolence training. And a lot of the rhetoric of the group, known as collectively as Movement for New Society, is basically trying to find a way to bring about change nonviolently, and trying to find a way to bring about change that both deals with the global issues as well as the personal issue. Because if you're just out on the streets protesting at civil rights and not dealing with the way you treat your brothers and sisters at home, there's some kind of a hypocrisy there. So personal and social change is a definite part of what goes on in the Life Center or the Movement for New Society. Another part that's very important is that in living in community, it's important to affirm diversity, but it's also important to understand a certain level of commitment. And people who live there commit themselves to a basic framework, such as committing themselves to nonviolent struggle, not the violent way, but the nonviolent way, to solving conflicts and dealing with people. Commitment to a term that, I don't know if you're familiar with, egalitarianism, sharing across the board to whatever extent possible. There is no one leader per se who sits above the rest of the people, but it's this notion of leadership where the group leads itself, and together they develop skills and a level of competency and then share that so that there's that learning exchange going on, so where everyone is empowered to, in a sense, discover how they can then lead themselves. There's the notion of helping out in a crunch situation. If I'm in a need, the community will help me out and provide me with the funds I might need rather than have to go to a bank loan. So there's that kind of sharing or security system there. The support of many people enables a lot of things to happen that a few people couldn't do. There's the notion of trying to everyone participate in the vision, the analysis, and the strategy of what trying to create a new, more humane, nonviolent society might mean. No, there aren't a group of theoreticians sitting back there trying to discuss, well, what is our new vision going to be? How are we going to implement that? What is our analysis of society? A lot of time is taken on reflection in education and consciousness-raising groups where collectively a consciousness emerges to what is important. So the dream for the future is very much a shared one. And for me, it was empowering primarily because it was something that I could do and participate in. It was something that a few people could work together collectively. It wasn't as incomprehensible as Holden with 430 people, millions of dollars invested in here. You know, it's much more replicable. And for me, it embraces the concern about the world, about people, in a nonviolent way, which I can affirm very much. And it also is a font freed me up to provide a lot of time to relate to people and not to be caught up in the hecticness of life.
Well, I've never lived in any situation like that, but something that I've always wondered about, what happens in this sort of situation when we really have a shared vision and a shared hope and so on, for someone who in all respects is a committed member of the community, who simply on some issue of conscience or some intellectual issue or something really goes a different way.
Mm-hmm.
How does a community deal with that sort of thing, and does it happen often? Do you work until the differences are overcome, or what?
Well, like as John said, the minute you identify or describe yourself, you attract a certain kind of person.
Yeah, sure.
But a lot of the, let's take for example the women's movement, for example. Back in the 60s, it was primarily a male-dominated hierarchy in which a few men made decisions. and there were a few turbulent years of dialogue and discussion, but since this is primarily a Quaker inspired group, you know, they have what they call Quaker dialogue. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it permits dialogue in a kind of like the parent-teen dialogue that we had here, where one group listens to the other without getting caught up in a back and forth exchange. And the other notion of the community is one of trying to listen and discern consensus, honoring the different viewpoints of everyone, and that's a lengthy process. All I can say is that the difference is respected and is a part of the dialogue. What might happen is a few people have found they've been frustrated enough where they've left and started again, but because it's not controlled by a few people, no one is to say what can and cannot happen, and because it can exist in various clusters, you can have very different households or collectives existing along one side. And that diversity, while not understood, is respected.
It just seems that if the sort of the binding rationale of the place is a Quaker type notion of consensus, mm-hmm. but at the same time you have the sense of urgency, that there's an important task to be done, and you know, we're talking about issues of violence and so on, and human justice, that the two are going to go somehow against each other sometimes, and that I just wonder how it works, whether you know, does it fragment, or people sometimes ask to simply abandon, you know, their individual point of view for the sake of the common.
You're saying that a justice issue might result in a violent response?
I'm saying that one of the issues you're concerned with, say, violence in society, there's a sense of urgency. The purpose of the community has to do with dealing with issues which are urgent. And therefore, if you're talking about decisions and strategies and policies and so on being developed by consensus, that's a very time-consuming process, and I just wondered if the two didn't sometimes run head-on into each other, and if so, how was that dealt with?
Quickly, the 150 people that exist there are not one large group, mm-hmm. but are broken up into household groups and into collectives. So if you're concerned about human rights, you might do, a speak-out to a monthly gathering, a potluck where people just get together and share informally, that you're concerned about what's going on in South Africa, and if interested people, please talk to me and we'd like to start a collective.
So then you identify by organization people. Structure, you try to minimize these kinds of conflicts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like every time there's an issue, everyone gets together and discerns that. It's like a few people go with it,
yeah.
and they develop it, and then more people work with that.
Yeah.
We've made all of our decisions in the Community of Christ by consensus, even when we had 60 people.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to describe to someone else. Basically, it was a decision-making process that did not take any more time than a typical voting and having winners and losers or a majority and a minority. But it comes after a level of trust and some commitment to be together for a while. You can't do it with a large group where you don't know one another, and you can't do it unless there's some commitment to stay together. Many times you gather, the one leading it gathers consensus and you move through an agenda very quickly. But if there is difference, you do not take a majority-minority vote. You wait until you have consensus, and usually if it's really one where somebody feels strongly, the group or person who has been opposed to the great feeling on the rest says, I think we have consensus, and says to move on, even though it's not unanimity, but you don't outvote somebody. Lonzo Del Basto at the Society of the Arc was asked when I heard one night, said, don't you sometimes, isn't it impossible to get consensus? He said, no, it never has been. He said, well, what if there's just such a great difference of opinion that you really have a division? And he said, well, we'll wait till we get consensus. And they said, well, I just can't imagine. And he said, well, one time we fasted for 28 days. And I, you know, it blew the mind of the one, I mean, sometimes I guess it would take that, but anyway, it's a
whole different notion of group process than what we've been brought up with parliamentary procedure.
Yeah,
and it requires a different way of looking at process.
As I was trying to understand the idea of community the other day, I was talking about the Greek polis as sort of the paradigm model of community, and there the presupposition is that the community is higher than the individual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you have that, if that's a primary commitment, then you will get consensus, and the person who disagrees, who yet believes in the idea of community, will be the one who says, I think we have consensus.
This reminds me of one of my colleagues at Augie, who is the clerk of a Quaker meeting, a very conservative Quaker meeting. And he said that I'm the only officer of the group, and I'm really not an officer, but it falls upon my shoulders to discern when we have reached the point of consensus. And he says, that is a tremendous responsibility. And he says, I know at times that there is no consensus, so that then it's up to me to suggest deferral for a while, to let the consensus emerge. But he agreed with what you said. It does emerge.
Mm-hmm.
It does come. But it takes an extremely sensitive clerk to know when to move ahead and when to hold.
Do other people have questions or things you'd like to talk about?
Does the leadership in any way, is that a shared thing as you described, or is there still, it seems to me that always there will be a few people coming out as the more outspoken people. Now, is that just the way it is? Or?
Yeah, there are a definite core of people. There are a definite articulate group. But even while that's true, the constant effort is made to try to listen to those that are silent, that don't speak up, that aren't as articulate, to try to include everyone. So in a sense, while a few might articulate and lead in a formal way, the whole group is included in the decision of where they're going. So it's and part of the emphasis is in trying to teach people skills and taking the time that maybe a person is a little slower, having that patience to help them along, rather than just having the gifted people to go on and do what they can already do. See, it takes commitment, it takes a level of trust, and it takes a level of tolerance, you know, in one sense affirming the different gifts that we do have and yet trying to find ways to share them.
Were there any other stumbling blocks that you encountered? I was just wondering, it sounds so perfectly replicable, as you say, so easy, I mean, not easy in that sense, but it seems possible to extend that and to have it work, because it seems like a very workable model. What are the problems? Did you see any other problems? I mean,
there are always struggles. Like, one of the biggest struggles, I think, is the sense of developing critical consciousness and re-educating yourself in a sense of understanding how our past upbringing and conditioning can really limit the way we relate to one another. Like, our notion of parliamentary procedure can get in the way of consensus. And that kind of a difficulty can always be possible. Or the notion that women are second-class citizens can get in the way of trying to include women in the decision-making process. For example, like what's happened tonight, we've all been men that's spoken. The women really haven't said anything, because men are mostly more dominant and vocal, and we usually jump in. And if we were really concerned about that, you know, we would maybe bite our tongue a bit and let a few women speak, or be sensitive to the fact, you know, of how the conversation's going.
Paul, can you explain what a Quaker meeting is different? There's several different Quaker groups within that area, and you more or less visit the different groups, so you find one you're comfortable with before you actually join it.
The household group, you mean, where you live?
Or just a meeting in itself. Quaker meetings, I've experienced it, or friends that have been in it. You go to a group meeting, if you feel like you're be part of that group, you will join that group. If you don't,
well, it's not that you will join, it's like you will enter a process of clearness, which is basically you become clear as to what the group is about, commitment to nonviolence, commitment to consensus, decision-making, what are the basic focuses of that are. And they become clear as to what you're about and why you are entering there. If you're just entering into community because you want to be in a group of people, you want to be in community, that's not good. if you're just coming there to sort of find yourself, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, without a sense of direction of where you're going to go, without a sense that you're going to help yourself get through it, then community won't work, because community, in a sense, takes strong individuals willing to interact in an interrelated way. And the clearness process is sort of a first step. It's like a novitiate into an order, where it's a trial basis, and at the end of that trial basis, if it doesn't work out for either side, you can say, well, it didn't work out, and then you're not stuck, or you don't feel in a bind.
I'm not sure, though. The Quaker, the starting of Movement for a New Society, or the Life Centers in Philadelphia, was largely Quaker. They are not, however, Quaker meeting houses.
Right, they're not.
It's, okay.
But, yeah.
But you don't understand the system, you have to understand the figure.
Yeah.
Other people?
I hate to break the trend, but I had a question for him. You mentioned communities that didn't last very long, 5 years or so long. Is that because you think they're based more on removal from society as opposed to having a purpose of, you know, being concerned in social issues? And, you know, they want to remove themselves from the removal and escape them.
Yeah, I've read a couple books on the movement of the 60s or even presently on communities and why most of them don't last long. I think there's a variety of reasons. And they're not, I don't think they're all bad. I think sometimes a community means a group of people who gather and have an appropriate response or fulfill some needs. And they're simply not nearly as concerned as the church is to make things memorable, manageable, and kind of perpetual. And so that it's not a great failure, that there was a kind of ad hocism or provisionalism. And I think that's one of the good parts to it. I mean, I didn't mean it necessarily as a judgment. We were just surprised. We thought we were going to be one of the newest, and of all the gatherings, none of them were very old, except Reba Place.
This sounds a bit like a German pastor that I visited was in Nottingham. He said, I see no purpose of there being a German congregation in Nottingham now. But, he said, we've got a building, and we're stuck. Because the building has to be maintained. He said, what I would like to do is just fold my tent and go back to Deutschland, because we served a community that needed after the war. But now we're just going on, he felt, for the sake of going on. And so it's a little bit like the church. Once it's there, the church doesn't want to break away. But he was a community-minded individual. He would rather have gone elsewhere.
There probably are some other reasons. I mean,
there's a good book that's been written by Elizabeth Cantor. Or is it Rosabeth Cantor? Anyway, it's called Commitment and Community. And she has done a survey of hundreds of communities. And it's just really impressive work. Published by Harvard Press. And the one thing that she says about communities that sustain themselves a long period of time is that they have a focus outside of themselves, usually a spiritual focus, a commitment. And for me, that's a very crucial part, is that when you only exist in and of yourself and have no reason for service or looking outward and just sort of confine yourself to four walls or whatever that is, you'll just atrophy and die. And I think it's that being thrust outward, the service or whatever it is, that keeps people alive and gives you a sense of mission, whatever that is.
I think the distinction needs to be sharpened a bit more than that.
Okay.
Because communities can have a purpose outside of their own survival, but the purpose itself can be realized and fulfilled. I mean, many, you know, sort of movement communities have a specific historical duration because their raison d'etre is no longer there. I mean, if they were to protest the war in Vietnam, say, and then we're out of Vietnam, that's it. It seems to me that the communities that survive as communities have quote, transcendent purpose, that is something which isn't, in the first instance, grounded in some particular fact, circumstance, state of affairs, historical, specific, social kind of thing, but rather manifests itself in all manner of social, historical things, you see. So, I mean, one of the differences between the church and some sort of ad hoc community is it does have a kind of transcendent purpose, and it manifests itself no matter how history goes. But a specific congregation, a German congregation in Nottingham, is there to meet a specific historical contingent event. And when that's over, then it, as that German congregation, is no longer a reason to be. But then there's the other problem, some of these sort of kind of self-indulgent community, and those, of course, I think, live and die for different reasons.
Are any of you familiar with the religious orders in the Roman Catholic Church, particularly the women's orders now? And I've had students who have gone and inquired of sisters, and they come back universally with the report that Vatican Council number 2 radically changed the women's orders. That before Vatican II, when a woman entered the order, she surrendered herself to the order. She conformed to the order. She gave up much of her identity in order that she might become part of the stereotype of the order. But over the last 15 years, even though there has been an enormous decline in religious vocation, those who do enter it don't enter it now to surrender their character, but they enter it to develop their personality. And for those who enter these orders, who choose to live under this discipline, it becomes for them the avenue to fulfill themselves and to blossom fully as individuals. And the nun of today is far different than the nun of 20 years ago. But there has been a very great shift in the purpose of community.
Well, at least in the understanding of that religious vocation.
Mm-hmm.
May not be the same, but formerly was the same, I think. I remember hearing or reading someplace here that somebody knew something about the Buderhof. Is that? I'm really just interested to learn a little bit about that, if you could say something about that.
There's a book in the library called The Joyful Community by the Bloch, I think. At one time was, I don't know, 9 different settlements all throughout the world. I think currently it's maybe 3 or 4. There are at least 3 in the United States, and maybe 1 in England or Australia, I'm not sure. But what it is, I suppose, would be similar to what we know as the Amish community. It's really a self-contained existence within a certain area of land where they have their own lifestyle, they raise their own livestock, for example. They have their own publishing press called Plow share.
I think it's just a plow.
Mm-hmm. They make community playthings, those heavy-duty toys that you see in daycare centers out of wood. And primarily they maintain their own existence as separate from the rest of the world. And in a sense, you might have few idiosyncrasies. I mean, their dress is noticeably different. They have their own school systems. They have their own child care. Very traditional in their roles in terms of what the men do and the women do. Women aren't permitted to do certain things. Men are primarily the decision makers and the elders of the community.
Didn't they begin as refugees for religious freedom?
Yeah, in Germany, a man by the name of, I don't remember his name, he was part of the German student movement, I think, turn of the century, in the 1900s, and they sort of had a household community and was very much led by his personality, very much dominated by a certain Eberhard Arnold, is that his name?
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
And he died, and then the community sort of floundered. It's been 3 years since I've been there, and I just know various tenements of it.
Where were you?
I was in the one south of Philadelphia, in Pittsburgh,
I think it's...
Isn't the book Children in Community with a lot of pictures, isn't that Ruderhof too?
I think so.
I know that they have a location in Griffin, New York, which is in the foothills of the Catskills.
That's the largest.
And we visited that place for a day. The purpose of our visit was simply to buy some children's blocks and make these community playthings. And, you know, the blocks, if any of you are in the market for them, they're cheaper and they're much better than any
quality
creative playthings makes. And so on. As I recall, I mean, they told us a little bit of their story. I mean, they were living a very simple existence. They wore something that looked like Amish costumes. Or
the women were long dresses.
Yeah. They had fairly strict rules. It seems to me that things like electricity and so on were used only where absolutely essential, and things like televisions or forms of entertainment were outlawed. They all looked a little bit addled because of what I assumed was excessive inbreeding. They saw themselves, it seems, as a kind of true believer. It seems to me, I'm not sure that they, somewhere in their history, thought they had revelation, a latter-day revelation, in some sense, like the Mormons, you see. They were living now as the people to whom God had spoken recently. And, you know, they were just going to stay there waiting for the apocalypse. But I'm not sure. I mean, under the most adverse sorts of conditions, they survived because they
have
sort of a transcendent purpose. You know? But
they used to be three times the size they are now. And in the 50s, there was a great schism. I can't remember the issue.
Uh-huh.
And about half the people left because they couldn't accept the leadership. And either you accept the leadership and are in, or you leave.
Yes,
so
there is kind of an absolute monarchy system.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Like, it was like a catharsis that had built up over so long because there is no real feedback. One of the rules there that really gets cited a lot is the concept of no gossip in community. They have an understanding that if Dave and I have a disagreement, rather than I go to Al, I'll go directly to Dave to work that through. And that one of the seeds of divisiveness in community is the gossip behind people's backs. That's one of the things that they're cited for very often. It just struck me right now. One of the problems is that if they go through school until junior high and then they enter into high school, there's a very difficult time of adjusting to the public high schools in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them don't do very well. So then there's a tendency then to go back to the community and not leave. And so it's the in and out group boundaries are strong enough that it's really difficult to go outside of it and function as a person, having only known what was inside.
I don't mean to preempt Friday. Are communities basically or historically utopian? Is that in the typology? Would Ruderhof be like the example that will be Friday?
Yes, because the one Friday that I'll deal with somewhat extensive are the Amish.
Amish.
And much what I've heard here seems to
indicate
there's a considerable similarity. Yeah. The Amish.
No, the book, The Joyful Community, is a good and critical look, and the Ruderhof discredit the book because they don't like that, you know, the critical aspect of what it says. And it's well written. There will be no discussion. We can end now. 9:30.
I thought we were waiting for consensus.